Hello, I'm Emma Desi, and welcome to another episode of Turning Readers into Writers. If you're brand new here, welcome, and here's what you need to know. This is a community that believes you are never too old to write your first novel. No matter what you've been up to until now, if you're ready to write your book, I'm ready to help you reach the end. I focus on helping you find the time and confidence to begin your writing journey, as well as the craft and skills you need to finish the book. Each week I interview debut authors, editors, and industry experts to keep you motivated, inspired, and educated on all things writing, editing, and publishing. If you want to catch up, head on over to emmadesi.com, where you'll find a wealth of information and tools to help you get started. Before we dive in, this week's episode is brought to you by my free cheat sheet, 30 Top Tips to Find Time to Write. In this guide, I give you 30 ways that you can find time to write in the small gaps that appear between the various errands and tasks and responsibilities that you have in your day-to-day life. Now, you might be thinking that you don't have any time to spare, but I can guarantee these top tips will give you writing time you didn't think you had. If you thought writing always involved a pen and paper or a keyboard, think again. If you thought you needed at least an hour at a time to write your manuscript, I help you reframe that. You won't be disappointed. Get your free copy of 30 Top Tips to Find Time to Write by going to emmadesi.com/30toptips. Okay, let's dive in to today's episode. Mark Boutros is an international Emmy-nominated screenwriter, independent author of non-fiction and fantasy fiction. He's a creative writing teacher, a mentor, a ghostwriter, and an editor. And I had a wonderful conversation with him not so long ago, where he talked me through how he got his start in television, why he decided to make a switch into creative writing and go back to university. He talks me through his trilogy, Heroes of Hestovia, and then he talks about the craft of character, his book helping you to flesh out the bones of your character, get to the core of them, and then ultimately bring them to life. And hang on to the end and you'll find out how you can either win a copy of his non-fiction book, The Craft of Character, or even his first book in his fantasy series. So keep listening. Well, Mark, thank you so much for being with me today. I'm really thrilled to speak to you.
Thanks for having me. It's lovely to be on.
Oh, it's a joy. It's a joy. Now, like many authors, you've kind of taken a scenic route to get to your fiction writing, to your novel writing. But your journey has perhaps been a little bit more interesting than some of ours, than mine, for example, because you've started out in TV. And you've done a lot of TV over the last, I'd say, nearly 20 years now. And so how...
Terrifyingly long.
Lots of experience. Yeah. How did you get started in telly? Tell us about that.
I'd finished university, and in that same way a lot of people find themselves would go, what do I do now? I mean, sort of cut adrift from 3 years of feeling like everything was okay. I applied for a job as a runner at a company called Talkback, who they'd made things like Bow Selector, Ali G, panel shows that I loved, and I was like, I want to do that. I emailed them, got completely ignored, and then tried again 6 months later, and three people were leaving. So they said, come in and have a chat. We need three runners. And then the next day I was working there. So it was quite a bizarre, it's one of those examples of timing works out. And then that's when I started, and I worked my way up through panel shows like QI, Never Mind the Buzzcocks, 8 Out of 10 Cats, A League of Their Own, and worked on various roles in those for what feels like an eternity now.
And I was looking at your website, you've done a few different types of roles. What's been your kind of favorite role to date?
My favorite, I'd say I had two favorites. One was the researcher, because that meant I was looking for content for the show. So on like Never Mind the Buzzcocks, I was looking for stories of musicians injuring themselves in weird ways, which sounds dark, but it's not. It's fun a lot of the time. And I was also responsible for the ID parade, where I would then go, well, I'm going to go and get the person who sang this one hit wonder I love and get them on the show. And I'd get to meet them. And it was amazing. I got John Parr, who did, I think, St. Elmo's Fire and some songs from the Transformers cartoon movie, which were amazing. And then edit producing, because producing's fun, but it's mostly putting out fires. Edit producing is when the show is filmed and you get to sit in the edit and watch it as a whole, and with an editor cut it down from, say, 2 hours to 22 minutes or whatever the running time is. So you're less involved in the politics, which is, that's when I started to enjoy it, and your hours feel a little bit more normal. Yeah, so definitely those two roles were my favourite.
Oh, interesting. We were talking before we started recording, and you've certainly worked on a few of my favourite shows. So that's exciting. But then in 2012, you decided to go back to education, and you started your MA in creative writing at the University of East Anglia, which is certainly, I don't know if it still is, but it certainly has been one of the best programmes in the UK. So what made you decide to take that sidestep to the more kind of prose writing rather than TV writing?
I'd always wanted to do writing. You know, it was what the MA I did was a mix. So I did, it was screen and a bit of that. So, but I always wanted to write. So I was doing that while working my way up in the TV industry. But I found as the hours got more and more kind of barbaric, I couldn't find time to write. I'd do like, here's an hour here, here's 10 minutes there, but it was all low quality. It was top of the head stuff. So as the kind of frustration built and the itch got, you know, itchier, I thought it's time to do it. You know, I had a few things happen where I went, it's kind of, I need to stop putting it off. I'd been accepted and I deferred it. And I was getting to that point, and I was approaching 30, where I was like, I need to make a serious decision about it now. You know, I'm getting tired working constantly on these shows. Mm-hmm. So I did that, and it was the best decision I ever made. Like, I don't regret a second of it. I loved it. And I got to meet loads of other writers who I'm still in touch with now. And it bought me a year to write, which is, you know, which I don't have now a lot of the time. So it was brilliant.
Oh, yeah, I think it's something a lot of us would love to do. And when I do interview people who have done an MA or an MFA, I love to kind of mine your brain and say, well, what were the kind of one or two things that you really benefited from, or the kind of biggest takeaways from that year of study?
The biggest benefit was I didn't have excuses to hide behind was one of them, because, you know, fear makes us kind of go, oh, well, you know, it would be going better if I wasn't in it. This was, no, I'm writing now, and I have no choice but to either throw into it. Any excuses don't really stack up. It's not like, oh, I was busy doing a 16-hour day. It's, no, I was lazy. And I got to meet other writers, because in various jobs, like, people will say, oh, you write, what are you writing? And you'll start talking about it, and then you'll see them glaze over, because they care a bit, but not as much as other writers. So you don't get that critical eye on your work. Like, now I have people I'll always send scripts to. And I learned a bit more about myself as a writer. You know, I was always chasing the joke ahead of the narrative. And I had my tutor who probably hated me, just absolutely drummed that out of me. And it helped a lot. You know, now the focus is on the character and the story, and the jokes are kind of icing on the cake, as opposed to the thing I chase first when I write anything comedic. It taught me a lot of theory as well, which I didn't think was useful until I was in the industry, and then realized how useful it was. And it, you know, it gives you kind of a toolkit for getting over problems you find as well.
Okay. Oh, do you mind expanding on that just a little bit?
Oh, no, not at all. You know, there's, like, even I didn't understand what the notion of a story world was before, you know, just everything that your story is about, essentially the people your character interacts with, the settings, all of it. So it made me think about that before jumping into a script, whereas I'd just go, here are a few characters, you know, where I'll stick them? I'll stick them in a bar. It's fine. Without thinking about those places a bit more and the significance and how they actually tie into your character, how they can mirror their internal struggles and their emotional struggles. Like, location is a powerful tool, as well as the minor characters you inhabit your world with and develop. And the best kind of the best bit of advice I was given was, it's something I kind of echo, is don't protect your main character. Because I used to write very, like, you know, I don't like the term, they call it the straight man is what they refer to that character as, which I think that term will probably get changed soon. Just your normal character, which, again, normal is weird. And they would do nothing apart from react to what was going on around them. And then all the secondary characters were far more interesting and far more enjoyable. And I used to do that a lot, because I was very protective of that character, going, well, they can't make bad decisions, because then people will go, I don't like them. Now I write horrifically unlikable characters, because I know that it's about making people understand what someone is doing, so they engage with the journey. They don't have to, you don't have to like someone, you have to want to spend time with them, or give them some redemption to some degree. But yeah, don't protect your main character was the greatest tip I ever got, and it made me see a different way of telling stories. It wasn't about someone having loads of things happen to them, it was someone generating those things. That person happened to the story, you know. It's that whole thing of not writing passive protagonists, essentially.
That's quite scary. I just listening to you talking there, and I'm thinking about my own fiction. I'm going, yeah, I've definitely had one or two secondary characters who are more interesting or more over the top, more exuberant characters. And the thought of making my own character do or say things that would make them unpopular does make me feel a bit uncomfortable.
We're protective, you know, we spend so much time thinking about it. And obviously, I don't know if it's the same with you, but those main characters are often the ones closest to us, ourselves. So I want people to like me. But, you know, it's that thing of, it's engaging to see someone make the wrong decision sometimes, you know, as long as you pull them back from it or show the consequences. You know, it still happens. I still sometimes drift into it and have to go, no, remember, don't protect your main character. It's so difficult.
Well, good advice there. And I was going to ask, you know, does your TV writing kind of bleed into your fiction writing and vice versa? But I think you may have kind of, you may have answered that a little bit, that there is a particular character, there's a bit of difference that in fiction, it's about the whole picture, the whole setting and not protecting your character. Yeah. But maybe in TV, it is about making that main character look good on the telly. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, because with that, with TV, it's about, a lot of it is about the name that will be attached to your project as well as to whether it will get sold or not. So you're trying to write a character that is really different and really stands out, and it will get shaped anyway through production companies you work with. So, you know, you'll send a script in to a company and they'll go, we love it, and then they'll option it, so they'll buy the rights to it for 6 months to a year to then try and sell it to a broadcaster. And optioning money is not great. So you're kind of working quite hard until someone actually picks it up, a broadcaster. But at that point, it will get changed a lot to fit a particular broadcaster as well. So, you know, I think the same principles of character really apply. The main differences are, you know, in fiction writing, you can get into their heads a lot better because a script is quite a boring document to look at. You know, there's no, it's not as sensory as a novel will be. Mm-hmm. And a lot is bare bones. Like they like seeing white space on the page in the format. Like they don't like to see long descriptions at all. It's something, you know, and also it's something a director then takes and an actor then takes, and it's a blueprint essentially. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, a novel, you are more directly holding someone's hands and leading them through. They'll still interpret a lot of things themselves, but you are the controller of that experience. Whereas in a TV script, you're handing that over for other people to interpret and lead someone on. So, you know, it's very much directors and producers will then, and performers will take your work and make it a lot better a lot of the time. whereas, you know, a novel is, it's a more, I think you're more closely connected to your audience in that way, where you are influencing so much more than you would in a script, I think.
Yeah. So it sounds like actually you get a lot more freedom as a fiction writer, because this is, it's a more solitary world. And so it's you and what you're writing rather than perhaps a team of people.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. You know, with fiction, I work with an editor, and that's kind of it, because I'm not traditionally a publisher. I think there may be more input there. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Whereas TV, for example, I'll write a script and you'll have a script editor, a producer, one or two exec producers, maybe one or two commissioning editors. Sometimes if it's someone else's project, you'll get their input. So you're looking at 6 to 7 sets of notes sometimes. That will all be collated, but that's a lot of opinions to take on and to make something work. And you know, it's not necessarily your vision that always shines through. And it's fine, because it's what will work for that channel and genre. Mm-hmm. So it's a highly collaborative process. Mm-hmm. A very difficult one, but also very rewarding at the same time. You know, I've met some brilliant people and learned so much by having so many people involved in the work. Mm-hmm. Not always perfect, but everyone's trying to do something good within it. So yeah, I find fiction, I get to unleash a bit more of my own creativity in that way. And thankfully I have, you know, good editors that stop me from doing anything too bad.
Well, talking of your creativity, I'd love it if you could tell us about your series, The Heroes of Pastovia. Have I said that right?
Pastovia? Yeah. I regret that title so much. It used to be called like Carl's Kingdom. And then I thought, well, no, I want to have something where I can explore different aspects of that world. And it wasn't really about him anymore because he was that main character that was going, actually, he's not as interesting as I thought. But it's really about, it's a fantasy comedy. Or a light-hearted fantasy, as I prefer to call it. And it's basically about a young man who's failed at everything, essentially. He never really left the kingdom he's lived in, pretty useless, but he tries. He just fails. And then one day a tyrant comes and invades the castle he lived in, the only place he's ever known as home. He decides, having failed at everything else, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to actually try and fight back. He's the only person who's silly enough to do that, fails miserably, can add that to his list of failures, and is imprisoned. He's been good friends with the princess. She frees him, sets him off into the world, and then he receives a message from her when he's a little bit away from the castle, into the world he's never known, telling him he's not actually from that world at all. The parents he thinks were his parents weren't, and he needs to find the portal home to find his real parents before he's captured and killed. And so his journey kind of begins. So it's about identity, what home really is. And I initially wrote it as a one-off, and then I found that I love so many of the characters that it was worth a second book. And I've just finished the third. It's off with the editor now. So, yeah. And then that's done. And I may explore some other characters within that world, but I think his journey is coming to a natural end.
Okay. Yeah. So it sounds like it's been fun, a fun trilogy to write.
Yeah, it has. It was a very, very silly comedy. And I actually went back and thought the narrative is being pushed away by that. So I reframed it, which was a very difficult process. It was probably 3 or 4 years in the making, that first book. Second book flowed wonderfully. The third book has been tough, but it's been very rewarding to get to the other side of it. And it's been so much fun to write. Like I'm sad to leave those characters behind now for a bit, but I think they need a rest for a little while. But yeah, it's been an absolute joy to write, and I've loved it.
Mm-hmm. So it's a trilogy. Are they sequential? Do you have to read one before the other? Can you read them as a standalone?
You can. I mean, I'd say they are sequential. Book two you could possibly read without book one, but you would lose some of the joy of a few of the characters. So I would say one is the most standalone, you know, because it was initially written as that. Like you could read one and then never read another and feel like you've had a complete story. They're all their own stories, but there are references that might get missed. So one is the main standalone one, and then I've got like a book X, which is a story about some of the villains in book one, which is something I give away on my website to people. It's a short story, and I'm working on some.
I'll let people know about that afterwards.
Thank you. Yeah, and I'm working on some origin stories as well, just when it takes my fancy, because I feel like the main characters have had enough of the kicking for a while that they need some time away from me.
Now, because I write standalone, I don't write series. It's and it's always something that fascinates me. So I know that book one was intended to be a standalone, but then you decided to add in the two and three. So did you kind of take a step back and think, okay, I need to have an overriding arch here, and what is that going to be, so that book three finishes off the whole trilogy? Or was it again kind of book by book basis? How did you work around that?
I did have to think about, well, what's now, if I'm doing this as a trilogy, there needs to be an overall arc for this protagonist. So I thought about what that would be. And based on some of the things that happened in book one, because I do a lot of planning, and then I normally know my ending, I know my beginning, I know some key beats. And then when the characters start interacting, a lot of that goes out the window and I get frustrated by the amount of time I've spent outlining. But some relationships emerged in that story that made me go, well, this is really about these two characters more than who I thought it was about. So I used that as the arc. It's really a redemptive arc. And that's what led me to book three, essentially. You know, it's really about this hero and the villain and the impact they have on each other's lives, weirdly. So I had that overarching arc, and then I thought about the individual book two and the individual book three, how they might work.
Okay. Oh, yeah, a lot of planning involved.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, it's I sort of see it as a, you put a destination into the GPS, but the routes you can take go all over the place. You know, yeah. Let the characters lead you. As long as I know where I'm focusing on, they can go as many directions as they like.
Mm-hmm. Well, nice bit of freedom. I like that. A kind of a hybrid approach almost.
Yeah.
Now, what was I going to ask? So let me ask, did you start the first book when you were doing your MA, when you had that year? Is that what you were kind of focusing on for your project then?
No. I wrote because I've written in television, I still script write for TV shows. I did a film and it was awful. But it taught me a lot because it helped me tell, because I'd always written for television. It helped me to tell a complete narrative in one script. Because while TV episodes still have stories, the overarching narrative takes place over a series, right? You know, over many, many episodes. So it showed me that, and it made me go, I want to do this. And it actually started life as a radio script, a 30-minute radio play. But it was so kind of vivid that I thought, I want to spend time, you know, elaborating on this world and these people. I want to do this as a book. And I, you know, and it was tough because it was like learning an entirely new skill. Because sometimes feedback I get is, I want more description here. This reads like a script sometimes. Put more in here and more in here, when I send it to my editor. And it's true, because I've always been taught to write very lean. Mm-hmm. Which is what script writing is. It's ripping everything out because you've got to get in and out as quickly as possible. But I turned it into a book and I loved every second of doing that. I found it a very freeing process, because you don't have to consider budgets either. You know, okay. You can have weird creatures and a whole world. Whereas for TV, it's like, could you set it just down the road? It's fine. You know, we've just got a park there. There don't have to be weird hybrid creatures in there. Just, you know, just have an angry dog.
And then the reason I asked that question was because you're still working in telly, so you've still got long hours, you're still busy, and you've got a family, you've got friends, you want to have a social life, all of that thing. So how do you find that you're able to make space for the fiction writing as well as all the other jobs and responsibilities that you've got?
It's very difficult. I tried Nano writing month.
Yeah.
My plan was to write book three over that. I managed to do 10,000 words. I failed miserably because I was doing a TV script at the same time, because there's no structure. So I don't produce or edit produce anymore, but I write for, like, I just finished writing for a kids series that took up 5 months, 3 days a week. I teach once or twice a week. And I freelance, write chatbots. Yeah, I do a lot of things. But what I do with my writing, like I started writing a dark comedy thriller last week, and I do it first thing in the morning. If I have the headspace, I get up at like 6, I get the laptop, whether I'm in bed or at the desk, and I'll try and do an hour or two before I eat breakfast so that the frustration doesn't seep in, because it is what I am most passionate about, is the writing fiction. And I find, you know, as soon as the world wakes up, you're getting emails, you can't help but check them. You're getting WhatsApps, you can't help but check them. So I figure if it's 6 in the morning, the world's asleep, mostly, apart from people who have kids. I just get up and do it, and I don't check emails. I don't put any music on. I just write in complete silence, and it's wonderful. Weirdly, on weekends is when I do that best. I did a bit this morning. I'll do it tomorrow. But there are days where I have so much on that I have to get up and just start doing the other things. So it does sometimes suffer for a few days on end, which is upsetting because, you know, I mean, I don't know how you find it as well. It's just balancing it is very tricky. I have to say no to stuff. I gave up drinking about 7 years ago because I found trying to do that with a hangover was a disaster. And so I had to make a serious decision about I kept saying, you know, if I look, I want to put that time in. I don't want to look back and be resentful that I didn't try. So that's how I do it now.
Yes, I think that is a big thing. That was a big thing for me as well. I got to a point where it was, okay, I don't want to get later on in life and say I didn't try.
Yeah, exactly.
So that was a big thing. But thank you for answering that, because when I've asked my audience, you know, what are the things that you struggle with to get your book written? And time is one of the big things. Balancing all the things in life is something you struggle with. So it's always great to hear from other people who are also busy and how they get it done. So sharing that.
But I think you can also be one of the, it's very easy to disregard writing time. So I used to put in my calendar, write 6 till 7 in the evening, and then it would come up and I'd be like, oh, I've already made plans then. So I think it's about carving out time that is uninterrupted, and you know, your loved ones will want you to do well, they'll want you to be happy, and they know you're happy when you're doing the thing you really care about. So factor in some time so that it's also considerate of them, so that when you do have free time you can spend with them, you're not going, can I just quickly do 3 hours of this? Even though they are incredibly understanding. And when I was very busy and I had to commute, what helped was having, I don't know if it's useful to anyone listening, but I had Google Docs, because you can use them offline and online. So I was on the tube and I'd be able to type notes on the tube and things like that. I just found those little bits helped. And if you find time's hard, just say you'll do 15 minutes and you'll find you do a lot longer, because mm-hmm. you can always find 15 minutes. It's when you try and go, I need 2 hours, that you go, oh, it's impossible. So yeah, there are little things you can try, but yeah, I find mornings is the thing that worked for me.
Cool. Well, lovely. Thank you. So you have, you've devoted that time to writing your fiction, but that's not all you've been writing. You have been writing some non-fiction as well, and you've written a book called The Craft of Character. So you did mention character a little bit earlier on, that was something that was a big learning moment for you.
Yeah.
Is that what prompted you to write this particular book?
It was, and I love reading screenwriting and story and fiction writing books. You know, I think like Save the Cat, the various versions of it, and John York Into the Woods, and loads of others. And it made me become a bit obsessed with structure. And one thing I noticed is structure became something that dictated what characters did, as opposed to it emerging organically through character, as weird as that sounds. I found it was a weakness in my work, where I was going, okay, I've got a character who, for example, a 35-year-old woman who has a heart attack has to change the way she lives. She's cynical, or she won't make it to 40. That was a comedy idea. I found that I'd go, okay, now I've got that. I know how she'll approach things. I'll put that into, here's the inciting incident, the heart attack. Here's what she has to do. She'll do that in this episode, and off we go. I didn't spend any moment thinking about her worldview beyond cynicism, what significance her job played, any of that stuff. I found I was always just tagging that stuff on. I was going, I'll make them a writer or a teacher. And I was like, how lazy have I been getting? And I figured the more time I actually spend on character, the more unique a script comes across as, because the more anecdotes seep out in the storytelling. You know, you get to, you feel like you actually know someone. And that's what I was lacking in my own work, and in a lot of scripts I read. I read a lot of scripts for places where I'd go, you know, it's perfectly, what a fashionable phrase in the TV industry now is to say something is functional. So you go, oh, well, it works, but I don't get a sense of who this person is. And that was my weakness. So I thought I wanted to write something that me 5 years ago would have found incredibly useful, and isn't just a copy of another structure book. I wanted to do something I felt would be useful to writers who were probably struggling with this thing like I was.
Yeah. No, it's definitely something I get questions about. So I know that our listeners will find it very useful. So could you take us through the kind of three main areas that you talk about in the book? You talk about the core of character, putting flesh on the bones, and then bringing that character to life. So it'd be lovely just to get a little bit more insight into those three areas and how you see them.
Yeah, so the core is really about how there isn't a story until a character wants something. You know, because, and one thing I want to sort of say as well quickly is, backstory is incredibly important, but it's called backstory because it stays in the back. You know, it informs a lot of forward motion, and bits of it will come through, but don't think that everything you put in backstory needs to come out. You know, it's never killed. It's just helped you get to where you are. So the core is really about the things you need in order to have a story begin. And your character needs a goal or an intention or a desire, you know, a want. They need something. So whether it's, I want to find a portal home, I want to get better, I want to win that trophy, you know, I want to win this race, I want to be the most powerful person in the world, whatever it is, they want something that we go, okay, I know what is motivating what you're doing. And then it's about understanding, it's sort of turning into a two-year-old that likes to ask the question why a lot. So it's then going, well, why do they want that? And that's when you start to get deeper. So you then go, oh, it comes from an emotion. You know, it comes from something they feel they need to fulfill. So if I want to win a competition, it's because maybe I've never felt like a winner in the eyes of my parents or peers. And this for me is the ultimate validation. And we all know every good story requires a lesson a lot of the time. And it's actually that, you know, I actually need to just appreciate myself. It's not about winning this thing. It's about understanding that, you know, loving myself enough to not have to seek validation in other people. You know, in that story, I would probably lose that race or you know, lose that competition. So it's understanding what your character wants, why they want it, and what perhaps informs that desperation that they need to overcome. Because, you know, they need to be desperate for this thing in order to make bad decisions to try and get towards it. If that makes sense, you know, in a very waffly way, that's the kind of thing I'm going for. And because people talk about just writing that first draft, but I think that's fine. But you need to be informed when you do that. You know, the story doesn't begin till your character, till we meet them and then see that they want something. Mm-hmm. There's no story without a pursuit, right? You know, otherwise it's just a lovely conversation, probably, which is still nice. But that's what
very
I think
exciting
is
exciting for your reader. Yeah.
No, exactly. But I think that's the kind of core, and the flesh on the bones is everything else about your character, from their voice, how they project themselves in the world. And that's all informed by, you know, their worldview, which is informed by how they grew up, probably. You know, how does what class they are inform how they feel about themselves and other classes, their race, their religion, where everything, you know, everything about us, my height, or, you know, I'm quite skinny, so that informs how confident I am in certain situations, or when I was growing up, how I couldn't speak to anyone I fancied, because I was like, I'm too skinny, I need to go to the gym loads. You know, everything about us informs how we behave in certain situations. And that's the flesh on the bones, because it helps you to fully, to turn that character. Because while the core is essential, it's still quite in the construct of a structure. It's the functional stuff. You know, the flesh on the bones is what helps that character to stand out a little bit further. And it helps you inform the world around them a little bit more. You start to go, oh, okay, then this is their friend who, and you start to see the dynamics between them because of their worldviews. Because you don't want characters who all have the same worldview or are informed by the same things. This helps you to create that difference.
Okay. And then bringing the character to life. So
yes.
We've got the flesh, the bones out. How do we bring them to life?
So bring them to life is getting them running, you know, getting them in there and getting them moving in your story. And there's a load of kind of how to write character descriptions is something I've been appalling at. So it's just to kind of help, you know, it's that thing of help us to create that image of them as well. I think it was the example of the dude in The Big Lebowski that I love the description of, which is sort of a 50-ish man in Bermuda shorts is at the dairy case looking at the labels. So you get a sense of who he is. And they say, you know, his rumpled look suggests a manner in which casualness runs deep. And I was like, that's great. You've not told me his face size or his eye color or anything, but you've helped me project this image brilliantly of this person based on a description of, you know, he's rumpled looking fine and what that suggests emotionally about him. And also in that bring your character to life, it's about putting them in situations in your story. So I get people to put their characters in situations such as with three other characters where maybe there's been a car accident or they're stuck in a lift, so you can see how they all act, essentially. So it's getting them moving, really. That's how you bring to life. And thinking about, you know, thinking about how they might behave in certain situations. So it's before you set them off into the story, let them have a little mini story with some people.
Mm-hmm.
We can see.
Yeah, I love that third one, actually, the, you know, bringing them to life and getting them moving and kind of highlighting how you can do that without saying they had brown hair and brown eyes.
Yeah.
Full description, but that essence of the person. And
yeah, exactly.
Kind of going on underneath. I really like that.
Yeah, it tells you so much about someone. It's like, I love that, and it really stuck with me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think describing things like hair and eyes and all that is fine slowly through something. And also in context, like if I'm a character, for example, looking on a dating website, then that's where, in the point of view of your character, that stuff would make sense, perhaps, because you're looking at those physical attributes. You know, you're not going to tell that someone has a casual, maybe, you know, we're not going to see them in action doing something, perhaps. But yeah, that's kind of what I like to try and do with my character descriptions now is to give them that, the essence, ultimately, as you put it. So I might have to update my book and put essence in.
I'd like an acknowledgement, please.
Of course.
So for your own work, and when you're helping your students, do you want yourself and your students to have all of this information up front to know this before they start writing? Or do some of these things come about as you're writing and getting to know the story and the character better?
I think I try and tailor my approach to be bespoke to their kind of needs, which is hard in a class of 20, but I have some groups of four. But really, I say, like, start with the what's your idea? Because your idea is either I want to write a sitcom set on a space station, and you go, all right, well, you've got no characters there, so we've got to get into that. Or you go, I want to write about someone who accidentally runs someone over and is now experiencing grief. And you go, well, there you've got a character. So I'll always bring it to character wherever they start and start drilling into those questions. So I'll get them to the core before they write anything. Some people want to rush and write, but I generally won't let them until they can tell me enough about their character, such as what's their goal, what emotionally is driving them towards this and why, and what do you think is the flaw stopping them from achieving this? What do they need to overcome in themselves? And what's at stake is very important. If there are no stakes in a story, why do we, you know, if your character doesn't feel the pressure, why? We won't either. So I make sure they have those things in place. And some of the flesh on the bone stuff will, that, you know, they might want to write quickly. I'll let them go a little bit and then go, okay, now I don't really know this character at all. We need to do some more time on their backstory. So I try and get them to do everything, but people get agitated and some people learn through writing a little bit. So sometimes it's a process that works in tandem. Mm-hmm. But it really is each individual. But sometimes you'll think they want to rush because they're scared to do that development. So if it's out of fear, that's one thing. If it's out of excitement, maybe I'll let them run a little bit and then pull them back. At least they'll know there's some safe space to come back to if they know they need to do more work, they know it's prepared as well. But everyone's a bit different. Like I've done it where I've had a very clear character in my head and no story in mind in terms of where it might go at the end, and then I've run with it a little bit just to get a sense of it. So it's kind of chicken and egg sometimes, but I think you need to know what your character's goal is before you send them anywhere, because otherwise where are they going? Mm-hmm. They're just, yeah. So I do try and drum that into people, but they don't always want to do that, because it's not as fun as writing. Writing's the fun bit.
Yes, I think I'm one of the ones who just jumps in with a bit of much excitement, and then there's a lot to go back and fill in the gaps along the way. So yeah, I'm definitely one of those. Gosh, now I'm just conscious of time, because I've been keeping you talking. Before we kind of move towards wrapping up, I'd love it if you could share with us some of the more common mistakes you see new writers in particular making when it comes to creating their characters.
Yeah, of course. It will be that the character is too passive, so they won't be driving any of the narrative. Their goal, there's no threat to them either, is one. There's nothing at stake for them. I'm trying to find the right word for it. They're just not particularly original in any way. You know, I've not get a sense that the voice isn't coming through in them. They feel like a stock type, essentially. So somewhat, because a common thing that happens is people go, okay, familiarity helps people, but it's also a danger where they go, okay, so that's our Joey from Friends. And you go, fine, but now what's the fresh spin we're going to put on that? So, you know, it's, have I seen this character before is a weakness. And then I'll suggest things like, well, have you thought about flipping the gender of this character or exploring what this character might be like if they're from a different background, trying to see, you know, trying to basically broaden the horizons of that writer, essentially. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it helps if they do a bit more research. Research is a beautiful thing that I used to hate. But it can help a lot.
How do you encourage your students to research character?
I'll find out what they're writing about. So, for example, one of my students is writing about a drag artist, but they have no experience in that world. And I was like, well, authenticity is important today. If you're representing a group you're not part of, you need to talk to that person. So they'd approach some people who are probably on RuPaul's Drag Race, and I'm sure they'll be willing to chat, and then they can talk to them and say, I'm writing a story about this kind of thing. What were your experiences like? Because we all have our own biases, you know. Mm-hmm. It's everything is based on what we've been exposed to and what we've read about. So by talking to someone who lives that life, it's wonderful. A TV project I'm working on at the minute is based on a true story, and we're talking to the son of one of the people we're writing about to find out about his life and what growing up in that area was like. You'll find it enriches your character so much more and the story by doing that. So take the time to do research. But I understand, you know, we're all in a rush to get something done and out there so that it can hopefully help us towards the next thing. But yeah, I find, you know, it's another, because it's just all these things I'm saying, I'm sure people, they're going, so that's more time and more time and more time.
But there's also that, I think that I can imagine as well, a number of listeners kind of thinking, because a lot of writers are introverts. And so that kind of idea of putting yourself out and saying to someone, I'm a writer, this is what I'm writing, would you be willing to help me?
Yeah,
we kind of think people will say no. Often people will say yes, but it's a difficult one for many writers.
A lot of people like sharing their experience and are kind of flattered to be approached. You know, I approached someone who worked on a body farm to ask him about how decomposing worked, which was grim and but you know, some people will say no, or some people will ignore the email. But I mean, part of being a writer is rejection, isn't it? We get used to it. And also, you're just putting yourself out to one person in email. It's not like you're putting it out into the entire world. So I'd say be put yourself on the line with that stuff, because the benefits, the positive that could happen is far better than the negative, which is just someone saying no, ultimately. Unless you go, no, and I don't want you writing this story. You know, just don't give that much information about what you're writing about. Just say, I'm writing about someone who works in this field, or I'm writing about someone who's been through this experience, rather than going, here's my story, this is what it's about. Unless they ask, then it's up to you. But you don't want to give too much away, because you also want them to talk freely without having their minds framed in something in particular.
Yeah.
You know, we'll all have our questions, but let them speak freely is ultimately the lesson there.
Oh, good advice. Thank you. That's really good advice. And I think your point about authenticity is very important, that you're right, in this day and age, it is one of those key things that everyone's looking for. So doing your research, I love it. So tell us what you are working on now. And you've mentioned a couple of things, but what's kind of taking up your time right now?
So I'm finishing the third book with the editor. I'm writing this sort of dark comedy thriller about a married couple who decide they're going to get divorced, but then accidentally run someone over, and now they're stuck together because they have to work on how to sort this out. So it's really about how shared experience may or may not bring them back together. So I don't know. I might be doing that to see if Kindle Vella emerges in the UK. I'm preparing that for that. So I'm thinking in terms of that one. And TV wise, I wrote on a children's sitcom that may be coming back for a second series. We don't know yet. They've been putting feelers out there. And I'm working on a true story, which I can't say a lot about, kind of NDA'd about it, but it's a true story about something that happened in the 80s. That was a bit of a phenomenon. And we're going to go and meet the son in a couple of weeks, but that should be very exciting. I'm annoyed I can't say more about it, because then it just sounds really boring. I'm working on a thing I can't say anything about.
Great. Suspense, you're giving us suspense.
Yeah. So that's kind of what I'm doing. I don't really have time for much else. I'd like to write a standalone fantasy at some point that I've been thinking about for about 5 years, but that'll be next year, if anything. Yeah, you know how it is. It's good intent. Oh, so many intentions of doing things, but yeah, not the time to do it all.
No. But listen, where can our listeners find out more about you online and learn more about how you help writers and your own fiction too?
Thank you. It's on my website, which is www.mark-boutros.com. I have a blog there, and people can contact me there easily. I'm not on Twitter. It got too shouty for me. I'm on Instagram, I think, at Mark Boutros Writes or M Boutros Writes. And that's pretty much it. I mean, I'm not really on Facebook. I'm not very active on Facebook, but those are the two places, really. If you like pictures of pigeons, that's Instagram. Otherwise, my website's the best place.
Fantastic. Well, I'll link to both of those too. Well, Mark, thank you so much for your time. I could have chatted for a lot longer. It's just time constraints, darn it. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me. It's been lovely chatting to you.
Pleasure.
Thanks for sticking around to the end of my interview with Mark. Now, if you would like the opportunity of getting your hands on a free copy of either Heroes of Hestovia Book 1, which is Mark's fantasy series, Book 1, or The Craft of Character, which is how you can learn to get to the core of your character, flesh out the bones of your character, and make sure that they are moving actively in your story, then I invite you to go over to emmadesi.com/Mark Boutros. So that's emmadesi.com/Mark Boutros, where you'll find the links so that you can win yourself a copy of either Heroes of Hestovia Book 1 or The Craft of Character. And if you enjoy the books, don't forget to leave a review for Mark on his Amazon page. Happy reading! Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I hope you found that helpful and inspirational. Now, don't forget to come on over to Facebook and join my group, Turning Readers into Writers. It is especially for you if you are a beginner writer who is looking to write their first novel. If you join the group, you will also find a free cheat sheet there called 3 Secret Hacks to Write with Consistency. So go to emmadesi.com/turningreadersintowriters, hit join, can't wait to see you in there. All right, thank you, bye-bye.